Huawei should be dead by now. They had to fight more and bigger sanctions than any other major company in recent history. But then, look at their revenues. They're not only not dead, they're basically back to their previous 2020 peak when the sanctions were applied. And look at their profits too. Those never actually dipped below a 5% margin overall, meaning that even in the craziest years, they, at least on paper, never actually lost money. Oh, and also, look at this phone. It's called the Pura X, which is not only an experimental new form factor, which a company on the brink of death could certainly not afford to gamble on, but it's also a phone that launched with Harmony OS Next. That's a proper new operating system Huawei has built for itself from the ground up to replace Android, Windows, and all the other foreign systems that they have historically used. Last quarter, Huawei also managed to regain the number one spot in its home country of China, meaning that after it fell from grace 5 years ago, it now is the market leader in smartphones in the world's largest phone market again. What's more, their growth is also not on the back of cheap devices, but increasingly that of proper flagships. In the premium segment in China, their platform called Harmony has more than twice as much market share as all Android brands combined, and it's also quickly taking share from iOS again, according to Counterpoint. And beside that, Huawei has also continued to massively expand its portfolio of devices, plus they also entered whole new business segments like self-driving software for cars, AI chips, and more. They made a huge comeback that was possible through the combination of some really interesting engineering, loads of help from the Chinese state, and also massive strategic blunders from the US, in my opinion. Let's explore. Disclaimer, I bought and imported the Pura X myself. Huawei Germany sent me these devices as review units, but they're going back to Huawei later, and no money exchanged hands. Instead, this video was sponsored by my streaming service Nebula. Before the bans that started in 2020, Huawei was an absolute giant. Their revenues reached almost 900 billion Chinese yuan, or roughly $120 billion, and for context, that means they had about as much revenue 4 years ago as Nvidia has achieved this year after its massive AI boom. Their biggest business segment was what they called consumer, which was basically phones, tablets, watches, and the like, and before the ban, they even briefly managed to become the number one best-selling smartphone brand in the world. They very briefly beat Samsung during the pandemic shortages, with their strongest markets being China and Europe. Huawei was even the only Android brand other than Samsung who successfully made their own chips for their phones, and by all accounts, those were very competitive too. Meanwhile, their second biggest business unit was what they called carrier, which basically meant Huawei supplying the networking equipment, software, and services for mobile network operators like T-Mobile, for example. And here, Huawei was pretty obviously the world leader at the time of the ban. But then the US passed new rules that were clearly designed to crush both of these big businesses. For telecom equipment, the US outright banned their use by American carriers and placed loads of pressure on allied nations to do the same. This made many of the world's biggest networks and carriers completely inaccessible to Huawei. Meanwhile, the US also placed Huawei on the entity list, which meant that any firm that used US technology could only do business with Huawei if the US gave them explicit permission to, which for many, like Google services and chip manufacturing tech for example, they did not. Those are clearly very big problems for Huawei's Android, chip, and telecom businesses as well, so they really should have killed the company, right? Well, I think they could have if the US and its allies actually went all out with the implementation, but that's not exactly what happened. For telecom equipment, China, of course, continued to be Huawei's biggest and best customers, while lots of non-US aligned countries like Brazil continued to use them heavily too. And even among allies, many, like Germany, who had huge deployments, delayed their pullout by many, many years, while countries like Saudi Arabia and Hungary, that are, I guess, at least nominally US aligned, not only did not kick Huawei out from their networks, but instead fully embraced them. And even more spicy is that just recently, we've learned that Huawei allegedly also bribed 15 members of the European Parliament to give them favorable treatment on the continent too. This case is still under investigation, but it's clear that whether it's through legitimate or illegitimate means, Huawei found plenty of buyers for its networking tech despite the US pushback. But anyway, even more surprising was that a while after the US chip ban, Qualcomm successfully lobbied the US to let them sell Snapdragon chips to Huawei so they could use those in their phones instead of the high silicon chips that they developed for themselves before. This means that Huawei could just keep making phones, with the one caveat being that they weren't allowed to turn on 5G on them. And this is such a ridiculous regulatory move. Like, what set of conditions makes Huawei a major national security threat unless they only use Snapdragon chips and only with 4G turned on? That makes no sense at all. I mean, I'm sure Huawei hated selling phones with only 4G when they themselves were the world leader in 5G technologies. It's very ironic. But of course, the phones still worked, and so they also just kept selling them. In China especially, where Google services weren't used anyway, Huawei's phone business could at least survive. It chugged along and waited for better days. Similarly, Huawei got an approval to buy Windows licenses, Intel and AMD chips, and other American components for their laptops and other electronic categories, so those could stay alive as well. In other words, American businesses lobbied their way into some sweet, sweet deals that basically kept Huawei's various businesses alive that would have probably died short-term without them. There's the saying that the US doesn't lose wars, it just loses interest, and I think that's exactly what happened here. The bans were enacted with big fanfare originally, and then the politicians kind of just lost interest in actually really enforcing them. Here's an analogy. If Huawei was a hydra, then the US had just chopped a few of its heads off, but then decided they got bored halfway through the job and then left. Except also its own lobbyists convinced them to keep feeding the remaining heads for a quick buck. That is of course a terrible strategy because the hydra is still alive, it's gonna grow its heads back, and it's angrier than ever. So here's what they did. Before anything, Huawei was in immediate need of cash and loads of it. The company suddenly had to deal with both collapsing revenues and also higher expenses as they needed to spend big to engineer themselves out of the various restrictions. Looking at their finances then, it's pretty amazing that on paper at least, profitability not only never dipped below 5%, but actually spiked in 2021. The biggest and most publicly visible reason for this is Huawei making the painful decision to sell off Honor. Honor was a sub-brand of Huawei, which at its peak in 2018 made over 70 million phones, or more than a third of Huawei's total smartphone output. Honor was a giant and would have easily been a top 10 phone brand on its own. So Huawei spun it off as a separate company, which Reuters estimates gave it a much-needed cash injection of about $15 billion. The spin-off was based on the fact that while Huawei was sanctioned, Honor, as a new and separate company, would not be. So if Huawei gave them a bunch of IP, their international sales networks, etc., Honor could make a comeback, especially on international markets where Huawei would struggle for years. Indeed, this has worked. Honor phones have had pretty decent sales, for example, in Europe once again, and there are speculations that once Huawei feels confident enough in a few years with their recovery, they could just buy the firm back again. And if you think about it, it's pretty strange that the US allowed Honor to escape their sanctions, because if Huawei phones are a national security threat, why aren't Honor phones as well? The company that now operates Honor is called Shenzhen Zhixin New Information Technology Limited Company, and they initially put out a really complex list of shareholders, but upon further digging, the controlling shareholder seems to be the, State-owned Asset Supervision and Administration Commission of the State Council of the Shenzhen government, along with some of Huawei's former business partners. This means that Honor is at least as entangled with the CCP as Huawei ever was. Now, it's beyond the scope of this video to discuss whether Huawei should have been banned in the first place or not, but I find the double standard with Honor really quite confusing. But, of course, it's great news for Huawei. Because with a huge cash injection from Honor, plus the slow pullout from telco partners, Huawei secured a few years of a runway during which the company could focus on reinventing itself. I dug through some financial statements to make this graph showing Huawei's R&D expenditures as a proportion of their revenues, and then also compared them to the figures of Apple and Samsung, and I gotta say, this chart speaks volumes. Before the ban, Huawei was hovering at around 15%, which was already way higher than their competitors, and by the way, they also outspent Apple in total dollar terms. After the ban, they made yet another jump with a peak of a pretty bonkers 25%. Now, this has two reasons. First, revenues collapsing automatically increases this ratio if the spending stays the same. And two, of course, Huawei also went on a mad scramble to reinvent itself. And these 20%+ aren't even the whole picture, because as I'll show you later on, the Chinese government also does a whole bunch of R&D, for example, around chips, and then essentially just hands that over to Huawei. Anyway, what did Huawei spend all that money on? Well, their first and simplest direction came from the realization that unlike phones, accessories like smartwatches and earbuds, for example, were relatively unaffected by the bans, even outside of China, and so Huawei doubled down on those heavily. They made them usable with any phone, not just a Huawei one, invested heavily into marketing, especially across regions like Europe and the Middle East, with me, for example, having attended their latest massive event in Berlin just a few days ago, and then they also spent a lot of money on making their accessories really quite good. The Watch 5 here, for example, has a titanium and sapphire glass construction, 4 to 11 days of battery life, top-tier accuracy for fitness tracking, and the biometric sensor not just on your wrist, but also one on the side for your finger. They say that this is because you can measure things like blood oxygen levels much more accurately on your fingertips, which is my medical-grade pulse oximeter's clamp on your fingers as well. In China, I also briefly tried a Huawei watch which has a little inflatable tube inside the band, so it can give you medical-grade blood pressure monitoring right from your wrist, while their earbuds have plenty of funky designs and high-end features too. While this is admittedly a smaller business than phones, it does seem to work globally for the company even when their phone sales have faltered, and last year Huawei was quietly the second largest smartwatch brand in the world, for example, well ahead of Samsung by volume. Also, with a Watch 5, for example, costing 549 euros, we're not talking about insignificant amounts of money money either. Then a bit more novel was Huawei also jumping into cars. With China having 200 plus new auto brands that all needed new software and electrical components, Huawei saw a niche emerging for itself, and so it developed a full suite of solutions for self-driving software, in-car infotainment systems, and more for them. They claim that they've sold 23 million components just last year, and they have tons of automakers on board, including, by the way, even Toyota, who made their latest BZ7 with Huawei tech in China. Huawei clearly thinks that the automotive business in China is relatively well isolated from US sanctions and also has big growth potential. And next, Huawei also doubled down on a few of its other businesses that were relatively untouched by the sanctions as well, such as a pretty massive energy solutions business that they call Digital Power. But most interesting to my audience, perhaps, is how they went about their two biggest problems, chips and software. Starting with software, while Huawei was banned from using Google services, Android itself is of course open source, so there was no mechanism to ban them from using that. In addition, as we said, the US officially allowed Huawei to keep buying Windows licenses for their laptops. So Huawei could have decided to just somehow make do with the setup, but instead they chose to go all out and to make a single, unified OS for all device form factors that they themselves fully controlled. The Pura X is the first device that actually runs a completely Android-free version of Harmony OS right out of the box, and meanwhile, just a few weeks ago, Huawei also revealed their first ever laptop running the same Harmony OS next, while they also have a brand new foldable tablet computer thingy that can do the same too. This version is called Harmony OS 5, or also Harmony OS Next. It's the fifth major iteration of Huawei's operating system efforts, and its development has been absolutely fascinating. Huawei couldn't just swap Android to a whole new operating system overnight, so instead they devised a pretty clever gradual transition. See, earlier versions of the operating system, like you can see with Harmony OS 4 here on this tablet, actually still operate with a ton of Android code. Here, Huawei has already replaced the Google services with what's called the HMS Core, which is Huawei's own equivalent. They ship not just the default apps like Maps and the App Store, but also all the background services like those that are checking for your notifications, security services for banks, etc. On top of that, Huawei also made it trivially easy to install MicroG, which is an open source way of spoofing Google services so that most of the Android apps just work out of the box. Then Huawei took Android and they started replacing it bit by bit using Harmony OS code. With each release, Harmony OS handled more and more of the tasks like authentication, device connectivity, etc. You could even run simple but native Harmony OS apps and native Android apps side by side at some point. Huawei also introduced a so-called kernel abstraction layer, which meant that the operating system could run either a Linux kernel, like with Android, a Lite OS kernel, which was running on their smartwatches, or also others. And by Harmony OS 5, they gradually got to the point where they could switch to their own kernel and cut Android completely from their system. Their whole phone now runs on their self-developed kernel, with their own app frameworks, etc. Android apps no longer run natively on the phone, and the only way to use them is by installing an Android virtual machine on top of the OS. In other words, the system slowly flipped from mostly Android with a little bit of Harmony to eventually just Harmony OS with an Android VM on top. For now, the virtual machine is needed because Harmony OS itself only claims to have about 20,000 or so native apps, which are sometimes also not quite on feature parity with their more mature Android counterparts. Now, the platform is basically brand new, so this is not a surprise, but the app gap will likely be Huawei's biggest software challenge going forward. We've seen Windows Phone and many other operating systems fail at this exact thing before, regardless of how good the operating system itself ever was. Anyway, while older Huawei phones can now update to Harmony OS Next as well, that doesn't happen automatically yet, because I guess Huawei wants to avoid randomly dropping an update on unsuspecting people that nuke some of their apps that they rely on. And another limitation is that Harmony OS Next is not available anywhere outside of China, which is why I had to import this phone myself. Technically, I found that their watches do seem to be running Harmony OS 5 even in Europe, but none of their phones and tablets do, as those will be the ones that have app compatibility issues. Just a fun side note. I had a long conversation with Leszek Lesner, whose channel I linked to below, and who has been using Harmony OS devices more extensively throughout the years than anyone else I know, and he said that while the system is improving rapidly, there's still some rough edges around China for day-to-day use. All of the devices Huawei sells over here therefore run on Harmony OS 4 for now, which still has plenty of Android code in it. I actually asked Huawei if they have plans for an international rollout for Harmony OS Next, and they said no, but I can't help but think that they actually think the answer is not yet. Surely they're trying to establish a base in China first, and they're hoping that their large market share, especially in the premium segment there, will force app makers to adopt the platform, and then with a Chinese ecosystem in full force, I think they can start working on an international expansion later. If that works, and if they also manage to successfully bring Harmony OS Next to laptops and tablets as well, both of which are huge ifs in my opinion, that would be a pretty massive deal, a proper third ecosystem. Now moving on to chips, Huawei used to design its own to power their phones, watches, cloud servers, and more, but like most others, it relied on so-called fabs or external contract manufacturers to actually have them made. The US specifically banned any fab that used advanced US technologies for making Huawei chips without a license, which of course was basically all of them in 2020, and that led to Huawei essentially not being able to have its own chips made by anyone. So unsurprisingly, the company went all in on building a Chinese chip manufacturing industry that could work around the US sanctions. Now obviously every part of this chip journey is extremely politically sensitive, and so we don't have all the exact details from the outside, but here's the things that we can tell so far. At the end of 2023, after years of hard work, Huawei and China's leading fab, SMIC, managed to make a new chip called the Kirin 9000S. This was China's first mass-produced 7-nanometer class chip, which was roughly equivalent to flagship performance from 2020. Both devices that I have here have basically an updated version of this same chip, and looking at synthetic benchmarks, we can see that the performance is okay, I guess, though clearly behind competing flagships. The CPU's cores I find mostly okay, but the GPU cores are especially brutal, and you can actually see the devices visually struggling with the admittedly intentionally overkill graphics of the Wildlife Extreme benchmark. This is not completely unexpected from a manufacturing process that is by now 4 to 5 years behind the bleeding edge in Taiwan, and so if you're a heavy gamer or similar, Huawei devices are probably not for you. That said, the benchmark figures are not what the devices feel like in day-to-day use. Just scrolling through the UI and doing normal productivity tasks feels really, really smooth, and I guess that means that Huawei has optimized the living hell out of the animations and the like to squeeze even the last bits of juice out of their weaker processors. As a person who doesn't actually game on their phones, I'm left somehow not really caring about the lack of performance in day-to-day use. We also know that Huawei likely used the same 7-nanometer process to make AI chips like the Ascend 910C to challenge Nvidia as well. I find it even harder to evaluate those from afar, but one report claims that while they individually fall short of Nvidia's most advanced offering, collectively in a cluster, they can deliver a superior performance to a rival Nvidia cluster product. Is that good? We honestly don't know, but the US did just warn companies around the world to stay away from them, so I guess they can't be too bad. Now, I think Huawei's chip business is actually in the same place as their software businesses. They've done the hard work, and now comes the really hard work. See, Huawei and their partners achieved their 7-nanometer manufacturing process with foreign-built equipment like ASML's less advanced DUV machines. But to go significantly further, they'll almost certainly need next-generation technology called EUV, which so far only the Dutch firm ASML has cracked and the Chinese are expressly forbidden from using. We've seen rumors of a domestically developed Chinese EUV machine recently already, and so of course it's not inconceivable that they'll get there eventually, but this is one of the world's hardest technical challenges, and so we don't know how soon and how well China will be able to crack it. One thing is for sure though, while the exact details are classified, we've seen report after report claim that Huawei is fighting the chip fight with the full backing of the Chinese government. A credible report from the industry publication The Elec claims that Huawei now quietly operates 20 different fabs across China, of which 11 are full production facilities. This means that they don't just rely on the likes of SMIC, but also quietly took manufacturing into their own hands too. And what's wild is that according to The Elec, the Chinese government actually owns the shares of these companies and presumably just lets Huawei use them. Meanwhile, an earlier report from Bloomberg also claimed that the Chinese government formed one of these facilities specifically to support Huawei. And we also know that the Shenzhen city government founded SiCarrier, a massive chip equipment maker that is now worth $15 billion, reportedly to supply Huawei with all the chip manufacturing equipment that they need. So this means that on top of the 20%+ of R&D spending that Huawei itself has, the Chinese government is also just throwing money at them. If you remember, the sale of Honor was also done in part by the government, so we can see that deal as basically a direct cash transfusion from the government to Huawei too. Looking at it like this, it's still impressive, but perhaps a bit less surprising that Huawei managed to avoid ever losing money. I mean, they got a ton of support when they needed it the most. Still, it's clear that in both software and chips, they've made a remarkable comeback, and these days, their devices feel exceptionally high-end and adventurous again. And so we can see from the revenues that their consumer business group, that includes phones and stuff, finally showed big growth for the first time since the ban. Now, while most of us outside of China presumably stopped following the Huawei saga very closely once it became clear that they weren't gonna get their Google services and other things back, there are of course people who did not. They kept their phones, kept tinkering with them, and kept seeing how they could work around the limitations. It looks like their patience is slowly paying off as the Huawei ecosystem is slowly becoming more and more usable again, and their devices are frankly becoming more and more interesting now too. Perhaps the most consistent and interesting voice in this community is Leszek Lesner, who I had a long chat with to get both his takes on how things went in the past and how he imagines Huawei might fare in the future. This conversation is available exclusively on Nebula for those who want to have a deeper dive, and it joins 24 other bonus videos that I've uploaded so far. I like regularly uploading these bonus clips for subscribers who use Nebula so that they can get even more out of a topic, and those subscribers also get dedicated Q&A sessions at the end of Friday checkout episodes, plus loads of high-budget originals including one from me and also other creators too. Originals like 17 Pages, a big-budget documentary that Bobby Broccoli has just announced, but also comedy shows like the hilarious Abolish Everything, which is very, very funny, or even Nebula making its own font, and then also making a documentary about the font. And our business model is refreshingly simple on Nebula. There's no ads and no shady tracking. Instead, you just support us with a subscription, and instead we give you more and better content supported by you. And better yet, with my link, go.nebula.tv/techaltar, which is also linked in the description, you can also get a big discount, which brings the price down to just $36 a year, instead of the usual $60 that you'd get while signing up with a generic link. That is just $3 a month and a pretty big discount, so be sure to use my link, go.nebula.tv/techaltar, or scan the QR code on screen to sign up. And if you hate ongoing subscriptions, there's also a lifetime option using that link. And once you have a subscription, you can even share that with a friend using our guest passes feature, so you can actually watch and discuss your favorite shows with them. Nice. I hope you like Nebula, and I'll see you over there.